أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear brothers and sisters, thank you for joining us for this special discussion we are to hold with our beloved guest. We are very fortunate to have Sheikh Dr. Farooq Sekolishvar with us, and we are very grateful and thankful to him for giving us this time and opportunity. Shaykhana, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
For the interest of time, inshallah, what we're going to do is we're going to jump straight into our discussion and the questions so we can fit in as much as possible. And inshallah, this proves to be a beneficial sitting for us. We are very fortunate to have you for some nights at our programs. A lot of discussion and debate came out of those programs. A lot of people started thinking, and we were bombarded with requests to have a Q&A session. Unfortunately, we weren't able to have one earlier, but inshallah, this somewhat makes up for that. So Shaykhana, in your discussion, you spoke about the issues that exist in living outside of Darul Islam, and especially when it comes to living under oppressive systems which are causing harm to Muslims and Islamic lands. However, some pose the question that when it comes to the West at the moment, not only are you able to propagate Islam in the general sense, but you're actually able to propagate what we would classify to be the pure Muhammadan Islam. In the sense that you can speak of the Khat of Imam Khomeini, you can have the Day of Al-Quds, for example, and you know, you can create spaces which openly and harshly criticize the Taghuti governments. None of this you can do in what would be classified as the puppet countries of these regimes, or countries which would be like more Islamic. At least in the apparent. So, how can we see our responsibility in this kind of situation?
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for organizing such a session, and it's an honor to be able to share a few moments with you and the brothers and sisters. Yes, so. It is correct to say that here in a country like the UK, you have some freedoms, or many freedoms, and one of them is to propagate the cause or the line of the likes of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi, for example, and the line of the revolution in general. One has that relative freedom to do that. And the question then arises to, can you live it though? Propagating is one phase, but living that line and cause, that's of spiritual value. Otherwise, just talking without walking, that would be of a limited nature in relation to one's spiritual growth. We want to live it. Yes, you're right. In many puppet countries, like in Saudi Arabia and other countries, yes, you won't be able even to speak out many issues. And in this aspect, you're right. But when you look at the bigger picture, you always have to have the hierarchy of oppression in mind. That these puppet countries are under the umbrella of one or two main countries. Like if you imagine a pyramid, for example, and the UK or America on top, then other countries in a hierarchical fashion at the bottom. Yes, you may not be free to do many things in those countries, but whilst living in the actual Taghuti system, in the hierarchy, the worse it is, you would be the trickling effect. You would be contributing to everything which is happening under you. So one shouldn't think just because one of the puppet countries you're limited, here is better. No. Here is the source of all the oppressions. We shouldn't get tied down with the small, the minor oppressions and say, well, we're oppressed in those puppet countries in a minor way whilst we're drowned in the enhancing the major oppressions of the higher countries.
And following on from that, there was an incident that was raised between a person by the name of Samad in history and a conversation he had with Imam Ja'far Sadiq alayhi salam. I guess in regards to this, there are two things that I want to ask. The first is this dialogue itself. Samad was afraid because he had heard the other mu'mineen say that if you end up dying in those lands, then you'll be resurrected with them. And so he went to the Imam, and the Imam asked him, are you able to propagate the wilaya of the Ahlul Bayt and invite people to the truth? And he responded by saying, yes, I can. And the Imam said, can it be done in the areas which are more Islamic? And Samad said, no, we can't even utter your names. And the response of the Imam was, if death overcomes you in such a place, you would be counted as a monotheist community. This individual we counted as a community. The light of belief will emanate from your face. This was from the greater sins mentioned by Ayatollah Dastaghib Shirazi. So two questions. One would be taking incidents like this and trying to apply it to our situation. How much room do we have to do that? And secondly, on the incident itself, if you would like to expand on.
Yes. So, in this particular hadith, which I hadn't heard before, but I've heard similar things to it, yes. But the operative clause is, can you spread the wilaya of Ahlul Bayt? Spreading the wilaya of Ahlul Bayt is not just praying in the mosque and fasting and seeing whether gelatin is halal or haram. If these two can be done, but one is disassociating from taghut. If these two can be done, yes, you'll be resurrected with the light, meaning the light of Ahlul Bayt. But this is the question. The general principle there is correct. From here, we see that the Imam has given the stamp of approval to this particular individual because this particular individual said, I can do it. But the problem is, can we do it here? And the wajtanibu taghut, we can't. Or if we can, it's very limited. And my question is even, ani'budullah, we're very compromised. But assuming we could, there's no problem.
And then the general idea of taking incidents that we see happening in history and trying to apply it to our situation. How much of a kind of leeway do we have to do that, you know, to take guidance?
No, we have to take it, but we have to understand them and then trace it back to the Quranic principles. Which Quranic principle is alluded to? All the ahadith that we have, the sayings of the Holy Messenger and the Ahlul Bayt, these are extrapolations they made from the Quran. And then they uttered them, they became hadith. And we have to do that too. Yes, everything that we want to understand through the ahadith, we trace it back to the Quran and try to. But the incorporating it in action, that's the challenge.
Another question which came up was in reference to historical precedents. So, unfortunately, I didn't have time to look at this myself to maybe bring up some examples. The questioner didn't use examples in this, but they made a general statement that we see the Ma'sumin, they sent their followers and students to different areas, not just within the Islamic world, but outside the Islamic world as well, into different communities. However, there appears to be no discourse or no overriding discourse which they did with those communities outside of the more Islamic lands, asking them to migrate. Rather, the overriding discourse tends to be in regards to strengthening them where they were. So does this not kind of show us that, in fact, there is another option, and which is other than migration, which does have precedence in history.
Yeah. Yes, many people have wrongly associated that. I've said that migration is a Sharia, wajib, injunctive duty, that we all have to do it right now. That's one legitimate option. The point was, when you're spiritually compromising yourself in a land of kufr and you can't compensate for it. Now, I may think it's a personal opinion that most people don't compensate for it. So if you can't compensate, there migration is the first course of action. Otherwise, if you can compensate, that's okay. And so in the Quran, we see many times and the prescription to flee from countries of oppression. That is in the Quran. Now, with the particular incidents with Ahlul Bayt, where they sent them, yes, that we have a duty to propagate, especially when the Ma'soom has sent people. And then we have to see how successful they were. Maybe they also gave the prescription there that if you can't, come back or flee. Even the history of Islam starts with a migration, you see, because of the oppressions that we're undergoing. Now, the migration to Medina is one example. Sometimes it was the migration to Ethiopia, or the former Abyssinia, so to speak. There, the king guaranteed that here you will be in a very tranquil environment and you're allowed to practice as your religion wants. We get the go-ahead there. He gave the go-ahead. But here, those incidents of 1400 years ago, to compare it now, we can get the general gist of it, the general formulae. But Abyssinia of 1400 years ago and United Kingdom of today, I would say are two different, yes, I mean, you can't even compare the two. There, he was given the stamp of approval from the Prophet, that head of the Abyssinia. Here, the United Kingdom killed 9 million Iranians in World War II with the drought that they caused and everything. These are two different, you know, governments we're talking about. And so migration is important, definitely. And the question of migration usually arises when you don't compensate. But if you do compensate, there's no problem. But compensating, wajtanibu taghut, has to be part of it. Not just praying and fasting. Some people may say, well, I'm praying and fasting, what's the problem? I'm fulfilling my religious obligation. Then they bring a fatwa from a religious marija who says that if you can fulfill your religious obligations, then you can stay. Well, the operative clause is if you can fulfill your religious obligations. Then the next operative question is, what is your religious obligation? And wajtanibu taghut again. Without that, that's an American Islam.
So bringing the discussion more to contemporary times rather than the historic precedents, we see after the Islamic Revolution, this discourse of exporting the revolution, exporting the ideals. There are places where Imam Khomeini says not just to Islamic countries, but everywhere the mustakbirin are against the mustad'afin. And there's this very famous quote from Ahmad Mutawassidiyan, who may be a shaheed. For those who know his story, know why I say that. Where he says that wherever there is a Muslim in the world, we will go there to help them. And if there is no Muslim over there, we will send a Muslim there. He will ask for help and then we will go and help him. So that kind of leads to the question that the primary position of Islam, especially looking at history, you can understand the importance of migration. However, in contemporary times, especially after the Islamic Revolution, is there room for Islam to say now, especially through the leadership, that in fact migration should not be your first option or the most correct option? Rather, now is the time to stand your ground
Yes, yes. So the exporting of the revolution is a prophetic seerah, and we have that. The Holy Messenger has done that. And the point is this, though, and I would even go one step further based on what Imam Khomeini, Rahmatullah Alayhi, has said, that wherever there's a mustadaf, even if they're non-Muslim, we have a duty to export the revolution. It's for all the mustadafin, all the suppressed, those who are suppressed in the journey to salvation, Muslim or non-Muslim. And that everyone agrees with. Now, but we have to succeed, and therefore we have to start. And it started, and we're doing it, and we have succeeded a lot. And therefore, if you succeed, it shows you're compensating. Okay, that's no problem there. My point with migration was, if you're in a system and you're not compensating for the intrinsic spiritual compromising that you're doing to yourself under that system, which this may include most of us, if we're not compensating, migration becomes legitimate. Otherwise, that's okay, you can stay here. But here you have to practice and live Islam. Islam has two aspects to it. An'ibudullah wajtanibut taghut. With what you said with Abbas Mutawassilian, yes, of course. I mean, he's that wajtanibut taghut, that's what led to his fate at the end. Yes. We have to, if we all act like him, Islam would be in a much better state today. But how many people are acting like him? You see? So yes, we have to export the revolution. The revolution, though, the pure Muhammadan revolution, not the American Islam, which would be forwarded and disclosed more if we don't highlight these aspects too. And therefore, only when we can't and we're not compensating, because by living under such a system, by default, you're spiritually compromising yourself. Only then, when you're not compensating, well, it's a rational duty that you have to go, albeit, you know, based on the Sharia and the Tariqah, that you have to leave because you're compromising yourself. So then migration becomes the first course of action. But no one is rejecting or denying the importance of exporting it, the revolution and its ideals. Yes.
So would you say that if you feel genuinely, sincerely, that you can maintain the conditions of remaining and defending Islam, defending the Muslims, doing your duties in terms of servitude towards Allah in its real sense, and fighting against the Taghut in its real sense, would that be the better option than migrating?
That would be a very good course of action. You would be succeeding. And as that hadith that you mentioned, you would receive the light of Ahlul Bayt. Yes. Now, which one's better? If you're truly succeeding, maybe it's even better than migrating. That I can't, you know, put a figure or say which one is better, but there may not be a need to migrate in such a, given the way you've posed the question, that would be ideal because you're succeeding now. Yes.
Okay. So for the layperson who's on the ground, there appears to be a lot of indicators which suggest that our current leadership, our current marajin, they do not want people migrating, just by the apparent indicators. So I remember you mentioned in one of your talks our relationship with the Charity Commission and how you can understand that, okay, if the marajin or our leadership has established centers under the conditions set by the Charity Commission, there could be a maslaha. And but I would take that a step further. I would say that not only have they done that, which could suggest a maslaha for them, but they are also at the forefront of funding and supporting the establishment of other community centers and other communities in the West as well. So when a layperson sees these indicators, it almost feels like it's being said that right now, migration is not what you should be looking at. Rather, it is try to strengthen yourself to the best of the ability. Even if you're failing to an extent, that is still better at the moment than migrating away. Otherwise, why are so many attempts being made to create those communities without the discourse being promoted that migration is actually an option.
Yes, I agree with most of what you said, until you said even if we're failing. If we're failing, we have to migrate. Because even all the Maharaji that you mentioned, they say if you're fulfilling your religious obligations, if you're not and you're failing, there's a problem here. And religious obligation with we have to look at first principles here. The charity organization that you've mentioned, with the verses which I've mentioned in throughout the lectures which I gave here, and all the traditions that we have on ma'unatu dhalimin, helping and aiding, and those who do that, their place will be in hell. And all these ahadith can be extrapolated from the Quran. When this charity commission is under Her Majesty, the Queen, and here you're promoting her, you're promoting that establishment, it's definitely, from a tariqah point of view, haram. And in my humble opinion, even from a sharia point of view, because the ma'unatu dhalimin, helping the dhalim, and dhalim here in the discussions in fiqh that we have in the standard books in the Hawza, like in Maqasib of Sheikh Ansari, the dhalimin are the unjust or oppressive ruler. That's the primary target in these discussions. And here, the Charity Commission, you're promoting them. Even if you build a mosque, she will be promoted. You're promoting her at the same time. I'm not sure this is even allowed. Sheikh Ansari has spoken a lot here. He has a very specific view that in the name of building a mosque, when at the same time you're saying her, when I say majesty, I don't mean it, saying it to what the local Joe Blog said. You're doing it under the auspices and permission of the Queen. In effect, you're promoting her. She is the guardian of the state and she is allowing you to do these things. First of all, this is very belittling. Second of all, it qualifies as ma'unatu dhalimin, helping the unjust ruler. And here, you're compromising the Islamic guardianship by living it, because you're not allowed to speak about anything, certain things. You're not allowed, they will control it. Many people have said certain things and they were kicked out from the Charity Commission because of Islamic Quranic things they believed in and they uttered. So this is a big problem. So according to first principles, the very structure of the Charity Commission, I would say, is haram. According to first principles, with the reasoning I tell you, it's a misdaq, an application of ma'unatu dhalimin. And Sheikh Ansari has spoke about this in his book, Maqasib. And there may be differences amongst the Maharaji, that's another issue. But the point that you have indicated, which I mentioned, is that when the leader and his representatives, because leader, we have one leader, the Maharaji are under the auspices of our leader, and they may do many things. They've been granted the stamp of approval from our leader. Leader is one. When a representative of the leader does commit such a thing, it's for a maslahat. That's one of the exceptions. And who discerns and ascertains that X action should be deemed maslahat or not? It has to be those in line in the representation, representing the leader, not for me and you. They have to give it. It has to be at the end, you have to trace it back to the leader. It's a choice that the Islamic leader has to say that. And when we see that the representatives are doing this, here we submit to them. There's no problem there. Okay, it's an exception. With exceptions, many things are exceptions.
As a matter of secondary.
Yes, yes. It overrules that primary ruling that you shouldn't. And they see the whole picture, they see something we don't, and we submit to them. We can write to them and tell them, all these things are happening. We just want to inform you. But they make the final decision, yes.
So when you look at the leader or the fatwa of Sayyid al-Qa'ib, or I should say in his istifta'at, someone asked, are you allowed to move to from a non-Islamic country, from an Islamic country to a non-Islamic country? He gave a response, quickly mentioned the first point was your beliefs should not be adulterated. The second was in reference to sins, so it seemed like a reference to actions. And the third was it's incumbent upon you to defend Islam and Muslims. How do you draw the line? How do you know my beliefs are being corrupted or not? Am I falling into that level of sin or not? And am I defending Islam or Muslims or not? To say, okay, like, I think I kind of fit the bill, and I can remain.
Yes, you're right, because if you were to ask that to any person, they will say, I'll give myself the pass mark, yes. So here, yes, these the aqa'id, the doctrine, the actions, and that kind of protecting the rights of Muslims and mustad'afin. Yes, we, in the dua of Abu Hamza al-Thumali, he gives 10 or 11 during the dua, 10 or 11 causes of spiritual downfall, ending one's fate negatively. And one of them was being distanced from the assembly of the ulama, being in contact with the ulama constantly. Not every day necessarily, but being in contact with them. Naturally, ulama are true ulama here, not any person who claims to be. And I had a teacher who was a student of Ayatollah Pahlawani in Qom. He said that this not being in the assembly of scholars is the source of all the other 10. Once this is compromised, each of those will sooner or later be compromised. He mentioned that. Now, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but it's something to think about. So it's like an MOT. Excuse me. One has to give an MOT to see whether the car is working well or as it should be working. Yes, you go to a garage mechanic, for example. Here, in relation to this, we go to the ulama who represent our religious authorities, the letter of the law, the sharia, and the ulama which represent the spirit of the law, the tariqa. And without that, we will otherwise fall under our egos, and we will always say, well, we're doing everything perfect. Why should we go? And here we're drowned. It's the ego speaking. This is not, you know, one has to maintain that contact with the ulama.
Sayyidina, as you know, one of the problems we have in the West is the lack of scholarship.
Yes.
The ones who are in positions of leadership within a lot of the communities in the West, I don't specifically mean the UK, but generally in the West, and even in the East to a large extent, they refuse to even speak about this kind of discourse, let alone, you know, propagate it. And there's very few scholars who a whole community or individuals can lean upon. Is there a second best solution to someone who cannot find a trusted scholar that can help them recognize whether they're fulfilling their responsibilities or not?
Yes, no, this is, I'm trying to highlight the importance of that phrase from Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. The importance of the phrase I'm trying to emphasize here, that they are manifesting Islam for us. The very fact that you're saying that many countries in the West, we don't have true scholars, this very fact itself is showing that what kind of Islam is being propagated here. And this proves my point, that most people don't even have access to the true Muhammadan Islam and how one should act the true Muhammadan Islam here. And this is what's worrying. And therefore they're comfortable with living here. They don't even know what their duty is. And they'll live here until the rest of their life. Now, their children, their future generations, the vicious legacies they're leaving for them, then for the next generation. When you see all this, you see, well, they're not compensating. It's not only not compensating, they're not even doing their duty, you see? And because compensating requires more than just one's duty. And therefore, that's here, migration is a must. It's a must here. And yes.
Interesting, Sheikhana. Alhamdulillah, we're doing very well for time. So if you do wish to expand on some points, you can. So one of the questions that came about was this idea of, okay, I realize I should be migrating. I'm in a position where I realize that I'm not fulfilling the conditions which allow me to stay, and I should be migrating. However, for one reason or another, and had lots of different people mentioning their situations in different ways. But essentially it came down to this, they're not in a position to be able to move. One of them, I think, may be important to highlight in that they said their parents are elderly and moving for them is not an option. Just health-wise, that's how much their health has deteriorated. However, the child feels that they can't stay here anymore. So what would the responsibility of that child be in that specific situation? But then in general, when it comes to someone who does not have the ability to migrate, and for example, they know that trying to get to that position will take them a few years. So in the time that they are here, what would be their responsibility? What's the best thing that they can do in terms of practical steps which could be useful for them? Yes.
There are a number of questions in that, the way you phrased it. Let's see, if I remember, I'll go through them, not necessarily in that order, but you see, so their duty, if it takes a number of years, for example, before they can migrate, their duty is to compensate. Okay? Now I'll come to how. At least in these few years that they're going to stay before they can make the move. But before that, when you're, for example, your parents are ill, every case is different. We have to look at it differently. Sometimes they may have brothers or sisters who can take care. Sometimes they may be able to convince their parents to also go with them. Because, yes, with parents, the benevolence to them is absolute. And it's on a par with Tawheed, as verses in the Holy Quran mention. However, the exceptions, you just don't obey them in sin. So if you're leading a life of sin in the way we've explained, and you're compromising yourself, here you don't have to listen to your parents. But let's say you are the sole offspring. When I say don't listen to your parents, I don't mean disrespect them, but you can make your move. But let's say you're the sole offspring. And let's say they're not willing, whatever you've tried the best in your capacity to convince them, but they're still staying here. Here, yes, this is one example that maybe you have to wait a while, because by just leaving them and assuming leaving them would lead to their, for example, health deteriorating and dying. Here, that's a very difficult scenario. But that's a minority of cases though, okay? We shouldn't try to get the exception of cases very quickly. There may be other ways we can sort the situation out. Yes, so there are always exceptions. Now, let's say if we have a number of years here before making the move. You said, what do we have to do? Well, first we have to compensate. How do we have to compensate? Now here, I'm going to give applications and examples now. But I'm stressing this, that what I'm about to say may be erroneous, and it's okay if it's erroneous, because it's the masadir, the application. I've given the general principles that everyone accepts. But when it comes to applications of those universal principles, we may vary in our opinion. For example, a religious authority, a marija, may say, whatever is intoxicating is muskir, whatever drink is muskir, is haram to drink it, and it's najis. Then that, okay, that's a general principle. Then that marija may say, in Pepsi, there is alcohol, which is of a muskir nature. Sometimes, yes. Then someone says, well, I know what Pepsi is. It has no alcohol whatsoever. Here, he can say, I thank you for your guidance and I follow you in the general principle, but in the application, no, I don't accept it. You're wrong. And that's okay. They don't have any duty. When they enter the applications, it's because they just want to guide people to make it easier for them. We don't follow a marija in the applications. We only follow them in the general rulings. So here, I'm only going to give examples. Don't panic or say, no, I that's wrong or whatever. It may be wrong. It's okay. So the same two followers of the same marija, one may drink Pepsi and the other, because of what the marija said, won't drink Pepsi. But the other who doesn't accept the statement of the marija will continue drinking it because he doesn't deem it as an intoxicant. The main problem in countries like the UK is the taxes that we pay. There are many others, but I'll focus on taxes for now. And the taxes that we pay goes to and is spent on things like the defense sector, culture, and education, and many other areas. And in these areas, a lot of haram is being done. And therefore, we are promoting this haram and aiding the oppressive ruler in their oppressive objectives. In the defense sector, for example, the military sector, all the weapons that they're sending here to Saudi Arabia contributes to the killing of the Yemenis, for example. In the shedding of this blood, we have a role because we're given the taxes. In culture, the LGBT scenario, tax is being, we're giving tax. With that money, the LGBT rights, and although they're human beings, they have rights, but the culture of LGBT, the promoting, affirming of LGBT is through our money too, with education too. If one goes through the different domains of where is our tax going? And then we have something called the inheritance tax. When you die, a very great percentage, especially in the UK, a large sum goes to Her Majesty. All this, we are promoting the taghut, the dhalimeen here, the unjust rulership by doing these things. And therefore, with each of these things, in accordance with the nature of those things, we have to compensate. So with what, let's say if it's 5% or your tax is 1,000, 5% is in the defense. Your tax went for the defense. 5% of 1,000 is £50. You give £50, give £100 to the Yemenis through whatever means you can. When a part of it is for LGBT, you do propagation against the LGBT movement, especially in relation to Muslim communities at first, but be active. And many other examples in this area, we have to compensate a lot. Even, for example, what to study at university, for example, what to learn here. Some people become doctors, some engineers, computer specialists, whatever, but they choose that for themselves because they see this is a good way of, let's say, earning money, or they like the subject. You see, it's focused on themselves. And this is only my personal opinion, but if they were to tell me, what does the Muslim Ummah need right now at least knowledge-wise, it's we need a journalist or a media specialist. What they can do to unwind the problems that we're facing is much more than what a medic can do. That's also a way of compensating. Look at all the rubbish we are fed through the media, newspapers, everything, and we are listening to it. And we submit to it, even if it's subconsciously. We can compensate, for example, with these different avenues of different sciences and everything. So this is now a very long area of how to compensate. These are just a few examples, but this compensating we would have to do in that interim few years period that you mentioned. Yes.
You also spoke about interest as being one of the other problems. Yes. So taxes is one problem. Another problem living in a, I guess, especially a capitalistic society is the idea that you're dealing with interest. Now, our scholars seem to have differentiated between dealing with Muslims in terms of interest, and even within Islamic lands, whether you can or cannot deal with interest, and how you deal with non-Muslims, regardless of, well, specifically, I guess, in speaking about the West or where we are living. So because that distinction exists, maybe you can expand a bit on what that distinction is and whether that does make it okay and not actually a problem.
Yes. Before I answer the question, sometimes you're in a desert or in a place there's no food except pig meat. Then she said, what's my duty here? And the religious authority says that it's, you can consume. Just consume that much which you can survive. You know, like one or two morsels of the pig meat so that you don't die, but not don't have the half a pig or half a, you know, a leg, for example, of the pig. Just to survive, okay? Then the next day comes and you're in the same place, and then say, well, there's only pig meat here. The manager will say, just have a bit to survive. Imagine that happens for 10 years. Do you see what the problem? That with an exception that we have, we've built a lifestyle based on it. For 10 years, he's consuming pig meat. Then the manager will say, for goodness sake, migrate. What are you doing here? Wasn't the earth spacious enough for you? You know? So in the Quran too, we have this prescription that, and I mentioned it in the lectures, Alam takun ardullahi wasi'a, isn't the earth spacious enough that you've limited yourself here? And you're just committing all these sins and fatuhajiru fiha, migrate in the earth. This thing with interest and loans and mortgages and many things. First of all, the banks are controlling the masses through these things. Although this is a different subject, I'm not an expert either, but it's common knowledge that they're, you know, holding on to people through these different, the way they get loans and give loans and give things on interest and mortgages and so on and so forth. Interest is haram. Whether you do it with Muslims or non-Muslims, I'm not sure exactly what you were referring to, that there's a difference. Maybe you're referring to when you see some rulings by the religious authorities that they say don't intend giving that interest. You see, this is a loophole. Here, the religious authority, just the manager, the faqih, their jurisdiction is just to maintain the halal and harams. They don't look at the optimum spiritual protocol. So they make a loophole like this, that you don't intend it. If they take it, okay. And what use is that? No, I respect the manager for saying this because they care for us here. They say, at least do it in this way. But it's like with the pig meat example. Interest is interest. And then some give these exceptions that, well, if it's belittling for you to live or rent a place, or and they'll say someone of your stature is renting and that's belittling and you can't cope with that, or your children will you know, reproach you rightfully for not buying a house or whatever, they say, and this is the only way, then you can get it on interest. So you have to be really constrained. This is an exception. But when the Magi says this and opens the floodgates, people in their millions will all say, it's an exception for me. An expert of the tariqah will never say such a thing. An expert of the sharia will, because their jurisdiction is just meet the people having a lifestyle and just do it in the halal way. And we have some mechanisms, sometimes there are legitimate loopholes too. But the point is, your spiritual growth, and that's not the jurisdiction of the faqih. Okay, that's the tariqah specialist. People like Imam Khomeini was both. But people, some may speak on loopholes and base everything on loopholes, and we then base our lives on exceptions and loopholes. Some know. They want you to rise, to raise your heavenly status. They want a much higher heaven for you. See, look at the difference here. You see, exceptions are for exceptional cases, not to base a lifestyle upon. You see?
So, there's a few things running through my mind with that response. So, it almost feels like there's this clash between Sharia and Tariqa. Rather than one lending itself to help you, you know, get on the other, or help you with the other journey, it almost feels like one is becoming an obstacle to help you on the other journey. So, in regards to that, what would you say?
There's never a clash between the Sharia and the Tariqa. Save when the exceptions happen. An exception by nature, by definition, you would expect a clash. But an exception now and again, not a lifestyle based on it. When your lifestyle is based on something which is spiritually compromising, what do you expect from the tariqa? Otherwise, the sharia, the letter of the law, and the tariqa is the spirit of the law. It's one entity, different dimensions. But the tariqa overrules the sharia. For someone who wants to raise their proximity to Allah, look, heaven, there are degrees. By getting interest under the auspices of the maraji, you're not going to hell because they've given you the exception. But what kind of a heaven do you want? Is it level zero? Or do you want to raise your heaven? The tariqa is working and overrules the sharia and is working for you to get to the topest level of heaven. And this point is very important, because the ills that you do in the tariqa are the cause of you compromising your sharia. It's a cause and effect relationship. Imam Rahmatullah has mentioned this in Adab al-Salat. And he says the fire of the tariqa is much worse than the fire of the sharia. See, that's one point. And then Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and I was very surprised of some people really being affected by this statement. And it shows the complacency that we have. When I said we would be on the enemy camp 1400 years ago with Imam Hussein, at best we would have been part of the Tawabin, but most of us would be on the enemy camp. The enemies there weren't failing in their sharia. They were failing in their tariqa. But the sharia, they wouldn't get interest. They wouldn't live on interest. Shimr wouldn't live on interest. He would do Salatul Layl. He would walk to Hajj several times during his lifetime. Things that none of us would do. But his tariqa failed him. And that led him to killing the Imam. You see? And Imam many times, he started with thousands, the movement, when he was going to Kufa, started from Medina, started with thousands, but they kept on lessening more and more. And many times he would say, if you're indebted, this is not the place for you. even though we're assuming the debt is, of course, a halal debt, but you understand, but your tawhid will be compromised with debts. And so we need a high level of iman to be part of the camp of Imam Hussein. Sometimes I hear things, we're playing with religion, we're fooling ourselves. We think that the way we practice and, in quotes, live a Husseini life, we're very complacent. And this has to be something that we have to work upon and really try to do something. Okay, what do we do? Well, compensate with what we've said. And if you can't, you migrate. Yes.
So, for a lot of people, you know, learning about the ahkam, learning about the sharia, and even when it comes to the exceptions, essentially they feel like by following what the maraji are saying, by following the sharia, they're doing their responsibility. And it's very difficult for them to digest that whilst I'm doing my duty of following my maraji, I'm essentially paving my way to hell.
Or not a high heaven.
So which one is it?
Yeah. No, because if you commit yourself to the sharia, you haven't sinned. I mean, that, how many people can say that? So there's going to be a degree of hell too, but eventually, after burning, the heaven will appear before them in the hereafter. But what kind of heaven? The point is, a sharia minus the tariqa is like a spiritless corpse. There's no growth. These two have to be done together. The sharia, for the sake of sharia, i.e. a sharia minus the tariqa, you won't grow. There were Sufis in the time of the Imams which were reproached. Why? Because they practiced the sharia and the tariqa minus the sharia. They won't grow too. It's a long discussion now. Each has its own pits and downfalls. But the spirit and the letter of Islam, both come hand in hand and both have to be abided by. Sometimes someone may do all the sharia, they do all the halals and the harams, but they're greedy people. They don't forgive. They hurt, well, hurting is haram according to the sharia. They're greedy, they don't forgive. They have many other ethical, tariqa, spiritual ills. It's of no value for them. And when you fail in relation to your tariqa responsibilities, when you fail because of the cause and effect relationship, sooner or later, you'll be susceptible in failing in the sharia. Love of the money, love of a car, a house, for the sake of a car and a house, forgetting Allah in these things, you're contaminating yourself. And you continue to contaminate, complacently thinking, I'm doing all the wajibat in the mosque, and you're not even doing the wajtanibu taghut. You keep on contaminating yourself, and that leads to a level, a threshold, where even the sharia will be compromised. Look, one has to say these things. The Urafa say these things. And Imam Khomeini, he's someone who, out of his love for the nation, the people, he's mentioned a lot of this. Why? Because he cares for them. If the ulama don't say these things and leave it like it is, they're doing a disservice to the masses. They're doing that. It's like giving, your child is ill, he has to be injected and given medicine, and the child says, no, let me be as I am. And you say, okay, look, that's a disservice you're doing to the child.
Let alone making them feel comfortable,
yes,
with the situation, yes, and in the oppressive state. So another question was in regards to Ulayat al-Faqih, like you mentioned in your final talk, a few points in regards to that. So I just wanted to open that up, which again may not be directly related to the discussion we've been having.
That is directly.
That will be, okay, inshallah. So this idea that when it comes to the Wali al-Faqih, and when it comes to the representatives of the Wali al-Faqih, there's this idea of accepting what they are saying, and then okay, you know, respectfully, if you want to write reports or, yeah. you know. However, why is this, or is this, or why is this kind of submission for that line? But when it comes to other scholars or other Maharaja, that's not the same. What's the differentiating factor? Is there a differentiating factor?
No, maybe there isn't too much of a difference. That even if a Maharaja, the representative, was to do something and you don't accept it, you write to the Maharaja. You don't, for example, disrespect the scholar because it may be compromising the status of the Maharaja, for example, or make him not look good or those kind of things. With the leader, it's definitely with the Maharaja to a lesser extent, the same holds.
Yeah. But would the following still be there, that you still follow what the rep of the Maharaja says on an issue which isn't necessarily related to fiqh, right. that you would follow your Maharaja
yes.
on?
Even if you don't, you don't have to, but you don't make an issue out of it. Yes, no one's forcing you. In that talk at the end of the third lecture, I was just trying to say that, be it with the Maharaja or the leader, that we submit to them, and if there are any problems, later, because the office may be compromised from the outlooker. You know, the negative things, the perception is very negative. Some people may say, actually, no, it won't have any effect on the perception. If that's the case, that's another story. Okay? But, and I gave the martyrs in the war and the stories we have with Imam Khomeini, though, they weren't ready for example, the Imam to be even inside, to be disturbed in any way, or, you know, perturbed or worried. But yes, that was just a personal, you know, understanding that I have, that we have to channelize the faults that we see from the representatives to the right channels and then act. Now, sometimes you see, God forbid, the representative has done something which is substantiated before you and it's so drastically bad, it's difficult not to shout out right there. And yes, and I understand that position. But I think the safest protocol of action is, even in such cases, you address the office. Yes, yes. That was a personal understanding, which I...
Jumping back onto our discussion, Jake, no? If you're in a position that you move to, for example, you realize that the Islamic Republic is the best place to potentially migrate to, but when you go there, you realize you're in a situation where when you were in Darul Kufa, even the likes of America or the UK, you were actually able to uphold those three conditions better than you are being able to do that in a more Islamic place, or even if it's the Islamic Republic, because of the situation that you find yourself in. Is it left for the individual to decide that, okay, this is the case? What would they go for?
Yes, well, with living in Iran, it depends. It's very unlikely for someone who is active and is practicing to go to Iran and say, in relation to those three, which was doctrine, actions, and propagation, yes? Those three?
Defending,
yes, yes. It's very difficult conceiving it is very difficult, that they go to Iran and they see they're failing in their aqa'id more than here. They're failing in their actions more than here. In such a case, something's wrong. They have to be MOT'd to see what exactly is the problem. Look, Iran may have many problems. For example, their immigration laws is very medieval. They're not letting people in. I always used to tell my friends, for example, that they should give a desert or a lodge or an island, for example, to the Khawaja brothers. Yes. For example, Las Vegas was a desert. Now, look what they converted it into. But we can convert it into a very good place. Or, for example, bring 1 million Lebanese. And then you can filter them. You know, revolutionary people. 500,000 Iraqis, for example. The numbers, I'm just giving the numbers. Although I'm not giving preference to anyone. And you can hear the revolution would thrive. It would be much, you know, stronger. Whereas right now, it's only Iranians. And then you have, let's say, 20% who are not for the revolution in Iran, for example. That would just rot. And then slowly spread, become more and more. Although at the same time, more and more religious people also will be. But the fact of bringing people in, yes, it's a failure with the system in Iran. I have no doubt there. The fact that they don't give citizenship, and these are problems, although they do give it to some degree, but very little, it's a problem. But that problem shouldn't stop someone wanting to go there. That's the ideal, to go to Iran. It's very difficult to imagine someone's aqaid and actions falling. If that's happening, something drastically is going wrong here. They have to really look into the reasons, because it doesn't make sense. And
would you say that would apply to not just Iran, but then any country which in the apparent is more Islamic, but they see... Because I think for a lot of migrant families, they found religion when they moved to the West. And when they were...
I would question that religion. I would question it. If it's true Mohammedan Islam or American Islam they found. I would question that severely. But... For example, but the point is, I'm not saying you must go to Iran. The Khojis, for example, can go to Tanzania and Kenya. Tanzania is a very good place. And it's relatively much freer. And the taxes are very minimally problematic. It's not spent on the things that we're spending here. It's a very good place to go. Even for non-Khojis, it would be a good place to go. For Pakistanis, for example, or Indians, Pakistan is a good place. They'd say, there's no security, they'll kill us. Well, that's what I mean. You'll be on the enemy camp. That's what they said with Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We'll be killed. So at least don't fool yourselves then when I say that you'll be on the wrong camp. But in Pakistan too, you're freer in attaining to your salvation. Yes, you may become martyred. Although maybe you don't want to be as active as some are. And you're in the villages or in towns which are not too difficult to live in, but the obstacles in reaching your salvation are much less there. And so there are many other countries that it's possible. Even in America or in America or in England, sometimes going to from London, moving to another place is less problematic. You see? Or in America, moving from California to South or North Dakota would be, that's a kind of migration in itself. All these are a question of degrees, and everyone has to evaluate it for themselves. There's a group in America, the Amish Christians, they call them the Amish, yes. I saw they came to Rome, a group of them, they came once, I saw them there. And they don't pay taxes. Allahu Akbar, look. Look at the wilaya there. They're not paying taxes. Look, okay, their lifestyle is very rudimentary. They're limited in many aspects. But look, it's one step ahead. How long do we want to live in this world? In these few years, we have to do something. That has to be a jihadi movement. Has to be a revolutionary. Has to be moving. Not static. Has to be dynamic and so on and so forth.
A phrase that you've used a few times, American Islam. Also recently, Sayyid al-Qaid also made this distinction between like the American version of Islam, the British version of Islam or Shiaism. Can you give a brief explanation of what these terms mean or the defining factors?
Imam Khomeini introduced this term. Where an'ibudullah wajtanibut taghut, if you take the wajtanibut taghut away and say, yes, no, I do my prayers, I fast, I don't have gelatin, and so on and so forth, I don't go to McDonald's, for example. Yes, I have religion, therefore. But they're not doing the Wajtanibu Taghut. This is American Islam. This kind of Islam, the tyrannical leaders, they're comfortable with this kind of Islam because they're not threatening us. That was Imam Khomeini's main gist in that. I'm just, you know, summarizing it. British Islam is another, or British Shiism, that the leader has mentioned, is a more kind of the next step here. And that's where within Shias, people are doing things to impair and compromise the unity of the Shias. Because he's saying British Shiism, not British Islam. And here it's a Shiism practiced which is inhibiting of the unity between Shias. For example, there are some things which are part of our religion, like the cursing of certain figures, but they make a very big issue out of it. And they do it in the open, in front of other denominations, for example. And this hampers the growth, you know, of even between the Shias themselves. And this is a very astute line the leader is referring to. And this is just one example which I gave. But whatever leads to disunity, you know, amongst the Shias, that he's labeled as British Shiism. Yes.
So could you say American Islam is a reference to a secularized version of Islam, and British Shiism is a reference to a sectarian kind of...
Yes, yes, that's... In general terms, it's okay, yes.
Sheikhna, thank you so much for your time. We've taken a lot of it. I have nothing else to add from my side. Just add some closing remarks on your trip over here. And if there's anything else that you'd like to add, then inshallah we can...
I would like to, first of all, thank AIM for giving me this opportunity. And I enjoyed the three nights thoroughly myself. I was slightly taken aback with the feedback, and I was even surprised to some degree, but that's okay. It's not something new. But in many WhatsApp channels, which I'm not connected to, but I've been told by members in those channels, people have, without even discussing it with me, be they scholars or people who claim to be scholars, have attributed things to me which were wrong. And I've been shown the text that they wrote in those groups. And it was wrong. And they're making me or affiliating me to certain places or people. And even the content was wrong. Now, I have nothing to tell those people themselves, but for the members of those groups, don't take everything at face value quickly. I'm very accessible. You can email me, you can WhatsApp me. I can always clarify it myself. And what you have done has clarified, inshallah, at least 50%, inshallah, until the next one. And you can always clarify it. Because some people have certain agendas and they're very erroneous in the things that they've attributed. And it's evident they haven't even listened to the three lectures. And it's evident that they haven't understood it. And when you have me, you can ask me. I'm always there for you. Now, through email or my WhatsApp, and those who have my WhatsApp can give the number to these people in these members. I worry a bit that these people may accept it and then take a different line of deviation. Otherwise, yes, I have nothing else to say. And I thank you also for bearing this interview. And yes, all the best.
Thank you so much. And please remember all of us.
No, you remembered me too. No, thank you.
When you do go back to Iran, when you go to Lady Masum,
yes, alhamdulillah, yes,
please give our salams.
Inshallah, okay.
To them.
Yes, definitely.
Inshallah, we can all make a ziyarah trip together. We can inshallah.
Yes, yes.
As well. I'd like to thank everyone who has joined us in this conversation. I hope it proved to be beneficial.